From a Republican convention to a new library to being at the bottom of the list for access to pre-K, those are just some of the things that have been making headlines this week in Idaho. And since it's Friday, it's time for our reporter roundtable. Joining me today to break down all of this is Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News, Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Press, and Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television joins us on the phone today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you.
So,
thanks for having me.
Melissa is in Pocatello right now covering the GOP convention. And Kevin, you're with us because you're not covering the convention.
Right. I mean, for a lot of reasons that are logistical that I'm not going to bore our listeners with, we made the decision a couple of days ago to cover neither of the conventions. And really, from a news standpoint, you know, I think some events kind of helped guide that decision. I mean, we cover education, right? And Shari Ibarra, the incumbent state superintendent, is apparently not going to be at the Republican convention. And unless something changes and she makes a sudden appearance, she's not expected to be there. On the Democratic side, Paula Jordan will be there, but it doesn't sound like she's planning any large events. So really, from a news standpoint, we just kind of looked at it and said, you know, are we going to put our resources into covering an event that may not have a whole lot of news value? And we went back to 2014 when the Republican convention crashed monumentally. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of attention paid to that. And there was a lot of outcry and a lot of furor about it. And it really didn't seem to affect the way voters approached the election 5 months later. So we kind of came to an impromptu crossroads about covering a convention and said, you know, we've got other things to focus on.
And Melissa, you are in Pocatello. The convention has started. Get us updated.
Well, right now, a lot of the delegates are arriving, so not much has happened. You know, Kevin's right in that this, for the average voter, doesn't have a lot of value when it comes to the day in and day out of what's going on at either of these conventions. But I will say that there have been consequential things that have happened in years past. You know, for example, the whole Republican closed primary first came out of a convention. This was the direction that the Republican Party was heading. And that has changed the shape of the legislature pretty significantly over the past several election cycles. You know, the 2014 convention that crashed monumentally, as Kevin so put it, you know, one of the things that did come out of that was there was eventually, after a lawsuit, new party leadership that was elected. And after that, the Republican Party was at least slightly more unified and arguably more powerful when it came to legislative races. The 2016 election cycle that happened after that, and after 2 years of that leadership, they were able to knock out several prominent Democrats. And so I do agree that the news value is pretty wonky and it's pretty selective. I'm not going to be covering the ins and outs of the resolutions, but I am going to be keeping an eye on party unification because at the end of the day, that does trickle down and affect the average voter, whether or not they identify with either of the parties.
Scott?
Yeah, and the Idaho Press, we're we're covering it with our sister papers in Idaho Falls and Pocatello. We have two reporters at the Republican, and Betsy Russell at the Idaho Press is at the Democrat convention in Caldwell, and we're really looking for the mood of the delegates and what are the messages that people are sending out. Paula Jordan did show up and gave a speech this morning, and Betsy told me that she'll be there all day today. So I think that I agree with Kevin to some extent, but I do think it'll have value for our readers to see what the mood of each of the parties
mm-hmm.
is.
And I want to shift gears a little bit. Tomorrow will be the, I believe, 2-week anniversary of that unfortunate fatal crash that happened right under the Cloverdale overpass in Boise. And Scott, you were saying that, you know, there are some questions now that are starting to arise. We do know for sure that Idaho Transportation Department has said that they have to completely rebuild the overpass.
Right, right. And they voted in agreement with Ada County Highway District to replace the bridge. It's going to cost about $6 to $8 million. But we started asking questions about why. Why did this happen? What was the signage? What was the tapering? You know, this interstate went down from 4 lanes down to 1 lane. And we're trying to get answers as to what was the cone situation. Did they reduce the lanes down adequately in advance? Did they put adequate signage up? Did they put up adequate flashing arrows? You know, this was a terrible crash, fiery crash, four people killed, three airmen from Mountain Home Air Force Base. And I just think that there's a lot of questions that are still unanswered that we're asking the officials.
Have you been able to uncover anything, or what have officials spoken to you about this yet?
They have not. And they have said that this is under Idaho State Police investigation. What we do know is that several people called 911 in the days leading up to the crash, saying that this traffic is dangerous. This construction zone is not right. We've been told that an Idaho State Police trooper did respond to the scene and checked it out and gave it the okay, and then communicated that to the Idaho Transportation Department. But what happened after that, we really don't know. And we've asked the ITD officials, and they say that this is an ongoing investigation. They can't comment.
Well, and I just know, I was out of town when it happened, but I just know even from my own Facebook feed, mm-hmm. there were, I'm friends with people that saw it happen, mm-hmm. and numerous people commenting saying that there was not adequate signage, that it was going down to one lane. Now, you know, those are witnesses, but the official answer, we haven't heard anything at this point.
Right. And I suspect it will come out in the investigation. At least I'm hoping that it'll come out in the investigation. But we have filed public records requests seeking some of this information. We've filed public records requests for camera footage as well. And so we're hoping that we can get some of those so that we can get some answers.
Any idea where they've said the $6 to $8 million will come from to replace the overpass?
They haven't said where it's going to come from. It's just going to come out of ITD's budget.
Okay. And speaking of I-84 and expansion, then we'll be starting in Canyon County, correct?
Right. That is going to be starting in September or October. And this is going to be widening I-84 to three lanes. It's two lanes right now. And anyone who has commuted between Canyon County and Ada County knows that this is a site as well of traffic accidents, serious traffic accidents. Backed up traffic. People sit in hours in traffic for hours. And starting in September, they're going to be widening from Franklin Boulevard to Karcher mm-hmm. Road to three lanes. And then they have plans to extend those three lanes all the way to Caldwell.
Because when you go Franklin Road right there, I used to work out in Nampa, and I remember when it was two lanes, and then they did that expansion just to the three lanes. But that third lane, it just kind of ends.
Right. Right. It ends right there.
Right there.
Where there's more traffic coming onto the freeway. And so it's going to be tricky. There are a lot of underpasses and overpasses and old bridges that they're going to have to expand. And it's going to take over a year to get that done at a cost of $150 million.
I'm speaking with Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News. Melissa Davlin is joining us by phone with Idaho Public Television. And Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Press. Of course, this is our Friday Reporter Roundtable. So, more bottom of the barrel rankings. We want to talk. We need to talk about this. I don't know if we want to talk about it. We need to. Kevin, lowest Hispanic graduation rate in the nation.
Mm-hmm.
This just came out, correct?
This is a number that's been out for a while, but it's been looked at again by another education nonprofit group. And the graduation rate for Hispanics in Idaho, the college graduation rate, is the lowest in the nation. It's 12.7%. Of Hispanic adults hold either a two-year or a four-year degree. That's an alarming number, and it's a very wide gap between Hispanic adults and the general population. It's something we're going to be looking at a lot more closely in the months to come. Scott, your reporter, Nicole Foy, did a nice job, did a really nice story about it earlier this week as well.
Yeah, she wrote about it, and the gap between Hispanic and white students is 27% for college attainment, and that, again, is the worst in the country. The gap is nationally, the average is 24.5. So not only are we the lowest, but our gap is bigger than anywhere else in the country.
And Kevin, any ideas as to why, once again, when it comes to education, something like this, Idaho is ranked towards at the bottom with this?
Well, what I think is interesting here is, it's coming at a time where the state realizes that it needs to try to get more high school graduates to continue their education in one form or another, whether that's college or whether that's seeking a professional certificate of some kind or another. We're at a point where, as a state, political leaders, education leaders, business leaders realize that something has to be done differently. And when you're talking about the Latino community, the largest minority population in the state, this has to be part of that equation. This has to be an area of emphasis. You can't get to the kind of goals that the state has set for the entire population without addressing this problem. And it's not just about hitting a goal. It's about helping communities and helping families and you know, helping people chart their future. I mean, that's what it's really all about. It's not just about a goal. It's about the human impact.
And then on the other end of the spectrum, we have what, the lowest ability for access to pre-K education?
Yeah, we're tied for lowest in the nation.
Oh, so we're tied, at least.
Yeah, we're right alongside of North Dakota. And the bottom line figure here is that only 32% of 3- and 4-year-olds are in some sort of a preschool, some sort of an early education program. These numbers can't come as much of a surprise to you because Idaho is one of 6 states in the nation that doesn't fund some sort of state-funded pre-K. That's been an ongoing issue at the legislature. The idea has not gained a whole lot of traction at the state house. These numbers shouldn't surprise anybody. They should be concerning, I think, to folks who are wondering about how are young children prepared socially and academically for what awaits them at kindergarten. But I don't think these numbers should have blindsided anybody.
We are continuing our Friday Reporter Roundtable. My guests today include Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Press, and Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News. I want to talk about this whole new unveiling of a plan for the new main library campus in Boise, getting a lot of buzz, Scott.
Yeah, first of all, it seems like forever ago, doesn't it? But it was only Monday. It was only 5
right?
days. But it seems like
it's just one of those
a long
weeks.
Time ago. But yeah, on Monday, the city of Boise released these renderings, these artist renderings from world-renowned architect Moshe Safdie. I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
I think you are.
But it is a massive library that is going to cost estimates of $80 million to $100 million. And then on Tuesday, Boise City Council approved a preliminary budget that includes $69 million for the library. Now, arguably, the building is beautiful and it's well-designed and would be a gem in the community. But the price tag is pretty steep, and it's still preliminary, but how they're going to pay for all of this is quite a question. And I think it's a legitimate question whether the city should be spending $70 million to $100 million out of their budget to pay for it. There's a lot of other questions surrounding it. The cabin is located right mm-hmm. near there. And what are they going to do with that if the library is encroaching on their space?
Well, I was going to say, because wasn't the rendering, they realized once it became public that there was not a spot for the cabin in the rendering.
Well, or the building comes right up to the
right
to the property. And so, you know, they're saying that everything is preliminary and that stuff is going to be worked out later. But it's definitely a big question. Parking is another big concern that they're going to have to figure out. And then, of course, the price, because as shown, kind of like those car ads, the price tag would be $103 million. And they budgeted $69 million in the next budget cycle. So still a lot of questions to be answered.
Yeah, and it's gotten a lot of, I think, criticism and praise.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a beautiful building.
Oh, it is.
And no question about it. And a great amenity. And the library is already extremely popular in this community. And so there's no doubt about it. And it would have an 18,000-square-foot auditorium. And it mm-hmm. would be the headquarters for the city's Department of Arts and History, mm-hmm. which makes sense. So it would definitely be a great amenity.
But the cost.
The cost.
Yeah. Kevin, Idaho Education News, you filed an open meetings request against New Plymouth, correct?
Yeah. We filed a complaint this week against the New Plymouth School District, and it goes back to the district's decision to hire a superintendent on June 18th. And it's not so much the hiring itself. It really has nothing to do with who they hired, but it has to do with the process, and it has to do with the agenda that was posted and made public before that meeting, which made no reference to the potential hiring of a superintendent. So the crux of our complaint is that that's a violation of the open meetings law because it does not provide adequate notice to the public that this is an agenda item. I mean, and you have to bear in mind the context of what's been going on in New Plymouth. This is a district that's been in turmoil for 6 months. The superintendent, the current superintendent, is leaving amidst an outcry. I mean, it's been kind of a soap opera in New Plymouth for several months. So under any circumstance, when a school district hires a new superintendent, it's a big deal. It's an even bigger deal in a district like New Plymouth that has been so torn asunder by controversy. That process has to be as transparent as possible. And what we're saying in our complaint is that it wasn't.
And when do you think you will hear about this?
I don't know. I mean, we just filed the complaint on Thursday. It'll work its way through through the process. I mean, you know, we're hoping that, you know, what comes out of this is maybe a do-over of the process and maybe some training so that this doesn't happen in the future.
And future, hopefully, with other school districts as well.
Correct. I mean, I would hope that the training is extended beyond New Plymouth.
I'm speaking with Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Press, Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, and Kevin Richard with the Idaho Education News. It's Friday, so this is our Friday Reporter Roundtable. Melissa, I want to bring you back into the conversation. Melissa's joining us from Pocatello. She's on the phone today covering the Idaho GOP convention. But I want to talk, Melissa, about get us updated about this article that you wrote. This is concerning a Democratic campaign manager here in Idaho.
Right. So Anthony Shalit, he's an attorney in Boise, and he's also the campaign manager for Democratic Attorney General candidate Bruce Beistlein. Back in February, Harley Brown, who is a perennial fringe candidate who frequently runs under the GOP ticket, rarely gets more than, you know, a handful of votes statewide, is famous, of course, for the viral gubernatorial debate that I created in Idaho Public Television in 2014. He ran again this year for governor, and Anthony Shalit had previously represented him on FEC matters when he filed to run for president in 2016. Anthony sent him advice on how to deal with the media after a police report had been filed against him by Nate Shellman of KBOY. Mr. Shellman had informed Harley Brown that he wouldn't be invited to participate in KBOY's Republican gubernatorial debate. Harley reacted very poorly, cursed at him, and then sent him a death threat over email, and that resulted in the police report. Anthony Shalit, the Democratic campaign manager, sent Harley Brown advice saying, you know, Nate Shellman is a biased kingmaker, emphasize this point, don't make any threats. And he did say don't make any physical threats, but do emphasize that the media is being unfair and un-American. This stood out to me for a couple of reasons. One, the campaign manager for the Democrats is advising a, you know, GOP candidate, you know, a candidate from the opposite party who was making death threats against the media. And full disclosure, we at Idaho Public Television also filed a police report against Harley Brown after he sent us similar threats when we declined to invite him to our debate this year. So I'll acknowledge that we also have a police report out. But that said, it's, you know, we still feel like it's a story, not just because of the party dynamic, but also in this environment where the media is facing constant criticism, not just from the public, but also the president and his administration and many people in state and local government. Any sort of escalation of that on any level or discussion about it that doesn't flat out say you need to knock this off, you know, this tone is not acceptable, we felt at Idaho Reports like it was noteworthy.
And Melissa, to be clear, when you and I were talking about this yesterday, the Democratic Party was not aware of these communications, correct?
Yes, right. It's my understanding. When I interviewed Mr. Shalit yesterday, he said that he believed some people at the Democratic Party were aware of his association with Harley Brown, and that he had offered this advice as a friend. He was not officially affiliated with the campaign anymore. He was not receiving payment for his advice. But when I contacted the Idaho Democratic Party, they said that, no, they did not know about this. They declined to comment further. I actually did just hear from Bruce Beistlein, the Democratic AG candidate. He said he isn't concerned at all and said that I should focus on other things to report on. But, you know, like I said, I maintain, especially in light of the news that came out of Maryland yesterday, that this sort of rhetoric, that Mr. Brown sent, you know, these sort of threatening emails that he sent to us, that needs to be part of the discussion. That's something that journalists face on a regular basis, not just from politicians, not just from the president, but regularly from readers and viewers.
And I think you bring up a good point, Melissa, especially in light of what did happen in Annapolis yesterday. If you are not aware, there was a gunman that came in to the local newspaper in Annapolis yesterday and killed four journalists and one person in their sales department. And based on the fact that he was upset with them, he had, I believe, filed a lawsuit back in 2012. The things that were written about this individual, those reporters didn't even work there anymore, held a grudge for 6 years. Mm-hmm. And this is something that journalists deal with. This was not, I think, surprising for those of us that work in this industry, in the sense of having someone who is upset with you. Scott.
Right, exactly. No. And I apologize if there's a helicopter landing about 30 feet from my vehicle right now, if you can hear that. So that's a lot of fun. But yes, you know, this is rhetoric that we face, and we faced, to be clear, long before President Trump ran for president. Almost every single journalist I know has a pretty frequent harasser, you know, somebody who, if they haven't sent explicit death threats over email or on social media, constantly harasses them and criticizes them in ways that cross the line. That's what I've experienced with not just Harley Brown, but other people in this line of work as well. And once again, that's why it stood out to me that instead of trying to de-escalate the verbal criticism of Nate Shellman and KBOI, that Anthony Shallett instead, you know, advised him to call Nate Shellman a biased kingmaker and fake news and call the media un-American.
And the media as a whole, un-American.
When the media picks and chooses sides when it comes to who to invite to debates, you know, that is unfair and un-American. You know, there has been a Supreme Court decision on this that allows media outlets like Idaho Public Television and KBOI to establish their own criteria on which candidates to invite to these debates. That's criteria that we exercise every debate cycle, you know, the exception being that one 2014 viral debate. So this is a precedent that is well established. We understand that it's controversial. It's not immune to criticism, to be sure. But invoking the words unfair or un-American and calling Nate Shellman fake news. Listen, I know Nate Shellman can be a divisive guy. Nate will admit that he's a divisive guy, but nobody deserves death threats.
Kevin, Scott, in light of what happened yesterday.
You know, I think the takeaway that I have out of all of this, I mean, first of all, I mean, for the family of that in that newsroom to put out a newspaper today, I'm speechless. I mean, we are a dedicated lot. We call ourselves, we always talk about how dedicated we are as a profession, but to do that under those circumstances, I can't imagine and I can't put into words how it. I'm very proud to be a fellow journalist and very humbled by what they were able to do.
Mm-hmm. And no doubt the rhetoric has escalated. You know, we live in a different environment these days. I know that this was kind of an isolated incident with a specific agenda going on here. But there's no doubt when the president of the United States is calling journalists scum of the earth and dishonest, un-American, enemy of the people, there's no doubt that we live in a different escalated environment now.
You would hope the rhetoric kind of tones down, regardless of whether this shooting had anything to do with politics at any level. You would hope that the rhetoric calms down, because the journalists that I know and work with and work alongside, if we get something wrong, if we've missed something, if we've made a mistake, if we've gotten something wrong, we want to hear about that. We want to get it right. So this kind of rhetoric that turns us into the enemy is not only unfair, it's unnecessary.
And I, you know, you hear many times about, you know, journalists have an agenda. And I am sure that there are journalists out there who have an agenda. I would say the journalists that I have worked with, the agenda is to get it right and to be fair.
Absolutely.
And so to be in this environment, to see what happened, and Scott, I mean, you put out a paper every single day. Mm-hmm. When you heard that they were putting out a paper today.
Of course they were. Of course they were. I knew, that's what I don't want to say the exact quote, but he said, we're going to put out a paper. It's like Kevin said, the dedication that we have to our jobs doesn't end.
Yeah. I want to thank all of you for coming in today. It's kind of a hard note to end on, but I think it was necessary for us to talk about that. So, Melissa, thank you for joining us from Pocatello. Appreciate that. And I'm sure we'll hear more about the GOP convention. Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News and Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Press.